Well, good morning. It's Jeff Wine, host of The Car Show here on Sun Sounds Radio. Folks, once again, we have an action-packed show for you today. Going to catch you up on the latest and greatest of the world of the automobile. Well, we've got lots of motorsports to talk about. Formula One, NASCAR, big news in IndyCar. We're going to talk about an immigration raid at an automotive plant. Yeah, an immigration raid. I've got a great story about a family who bought a Blazer and had it converted to a camper. Yeah, a Blazer camper. And then I've got a personal story from our auto shop on Friday about a kitty cat whose name is now Dash. And you'll get some more details on that. Of course, we'll talk about what's going on right now with gas prices. And of course, it wouldn't be the car show without a little car talk. You know what to do. Fasten those seatbelts nice and tight. It's going to be a fast ride on the car show. Well, from the pages of old cars, guess what? It's called, the article is called, It's, Hey, That's a Blazer. Well, Paul had grown up being used to getting used to delayed reactions when he rolls up in their vintage camper. He knows people probably think to themselves, well, that's a nice old camper. And that's a pretty nice Chevy pickup truck underneath. And then for a moment later, it hits him. Hey, that's not a pickup truck. That's a Blazer. And sure enough, someone actually turned a Hugger Orange 1972 K5 Blazer convertible into an all-in-one family camper. And that's something that Paul's dad, Lynn, who bought the Blazer, knew from the Chevy dealer in Hortonville, Wisconsin. And from there, they shipped it to a now long defunct camper manufacturing company in Minnesota and had it fitted for a family of four. Some 95,000 miles and 53 years later, the camper is still on the Blazer, the rig that the family and his dad took for all those camping trips. Both father and son always get a chuckle when confused onlookers look at this and say, hey, it's a Blazer. It's like they've seen a unicorn. So as far as Paul knows, it's pretty much the only one out there. Now, the camper top was supplied by a company called Ronco Coaches, and they believe that they will only come across one similar unit, but it wasn't on a Blazer. Yeah, we keep in touch with a guy with a GMC from Grand Rapids. He's got a 1970 GMC version of this with the same exact camper. I talked to him. We keep in touch. We really don't know about any other ones. I'm hoping there are some other ones out there. That would be great to see. It would be awesome. They made pickup toppers, too. I've never seen a topper on a full-size pickup truck yet. Supposedly, they were in business for about 10 years. But I've talked to people that are in their town in Minnesota, and they didn't even remember the company even existed. Well, Len says the idea of the Blazer camper wasn't originally even his. He remembers being in the market for a camper for he and his wife with their two young boys in the early 70s. They went to the local Chevy dealership, and they pitched him the idea. My wife really wanted a camper, and we went to the Chevy dealer, and we were looking at Blazers. And the salesman said, hey, I know there's a place where you can put a camper on a Blazer. And we said, okay, order us one. So he ordered us one in blue. And when it came in, you know, your Blazer turned into a red one. And then we said, that's fine. And then we had it shipped out to Minnesota to have the camper put on it. Everything was perfect. We flew up there. The guy was at the airport. We looked it over. It was nice. It's exactly the way we wanted it. They had different deals on the inside. We wanted the bunk beds there for the two boys so they could sleep, and then we could sleep above them. After we got it, they finished it up. We stayed overnight, and then we drove it back. Lynn said they paid $5,500 for the K5 Blazer. That same amount weighs in. The family soon took off for their first big adventure in South Dakota. Now, Mom died 23 years ago, and she was the one that loved this the best, Paul said. When we first got it, we went to Deadwood, South Dakota, and she bought a little beaded Indian and hung it from the rearview mirror, and it's hung there all these years. 53, I guess. I'm trying to keep this truck exactly the way it was when we bought it. Now, Ford, an International Harvester, had already launched lines of utility trucks by this time that General Motors mounted their big response in the late 60s. International had made their first big impression with their Enduring Scout. Ford followed it up in 1966 with a similar capable and designed Bronco, and both are heading down the same road that Willys and Jeep CJs, which started their beginnings in the World War II military era Jeeps. Now, with a shortened pickup chassis for new for 1969, the Blazer and the GMC Jimmy were bigger machines than either the Scout or the Bronco, which probably made them a little bit more appealing as a truck because they could pull double duty as a family hauler. But off-road, they were a little less nimble. Now, the body was either an open convertible top, or buyers could choose between the soft top or a fiberglass hard top. The Blazer and the GMC were fitted with half-ton trucks, but instead of riding on a 115-inch wheelbase, which was the shortest chassis at the time, their wheelbase was shortened to just 104 inches. There was no divider between the cab and the bed, no windows, no frame, no doors. Shifting was done either by a choice of 3-speed or 4-speed automatic or a 3-speed manual transmission. When debuted in 1969, the Blazer and the Jimmy were only offered as 4x4s. Two-wheel drive versions were added a year later in 1970. But the buyers overwhelmingly chose the 4x4s. Manual locking hubs were optional. Four-wheel drive version had a solid axle up front and used leaf springs in the front and rear, and the two-wheel drive version came with independent front suspension, trailing arms with coil springs. Both versions used drum brakes for all four wheels until 1971. And then the entire GM line was fitted with front disc brakes as standard equipment with drums in the rear. Now, since these were 4x4s, they had two transfer cases that were offered. The Rock Hard Dana 20 came available with manual transmissions, or the MP205. Chevy built a modest 4,935 Blazers for its rookie year in 1969, but production quickly ramped up, and for 1972, it had grown to over 44,000 vehicles produced. Well, Lynn opted for the 350 V8 with wheel covers on the new Blazer. That's about the only accessory that all the other accessories belonged to Ronco. Dad wanted the big V8 so he could pull the vote. It's a standard model with painted bumpers, not chrome. That would have been the CST, or the Custom Sport Truck. But it also did come with a console in the middle, and Mom wanted to be able to get into the back in between. It had a soft top, which obviously they took off at the dealership, and that's the original Hugger Orange K22. It's actually called Red Orange, the original hubcaps. Now, the tire was mounted in the back, but we have the bunk beds there, so we had to build a bracket and mounted the spare on the front. That was all a part of the camper package. Now, the family rolled plenty of miles on the K5 camper every summer during the 70s, but the odometer started to slow down as the boys got a little bit older. The camping trips were fewer and far between, and eventually Paul decided to buy the truck from his dad and keep it for posterity's sake because he couldn't bear to part with it. Actually, it wound up sitting for many years. I bet it was probably a dozen. I had it inside and covered, but I finally said to Dad, I got to get that Blazer out. I want to start showing that thing. Well, Paul had some body repainted below the belt line, did some carburetor and fuel pump work. Other than that, pretty much the same truck with a little cleanup and a little detailing. Inside, he took out the sink and unhooked some of the heating and plumbing. Otherwise, he's keeping the camper intact. I've got a few little things I want to do, but I really don't want to touch that camper part because I'm afraid with it being wood, I might be opening up a can of worms. But also, too, I want to remember it just the way it was when we were camping as kids. I do have a little bit of body work I want to do. I have a new bumper to put on it. The step from the back is something that they thought up at Ronco with all the leftovers they had. I'm going to redo that and clean it up a bit. Paul said he had a hunch that the K5 Blazer would be a hit at car shows, and he was right. It drew a steady stream of onlookers at the Iola car show in Wisconsin. He said the Blazer never lacks for attention, no matter where we take it. I was at a vintage camping show in June. It was like there were bees around this thing. Nobody knew exactly something like this existed. It's quite the conversation piece. Of course, with that red color, it really stands out. With Blazers and their brethren pickup trucks from that era are big collector items these days. Best examples have topped $100,000 at auctions and private sales. And it's no surprise that he's had other bow tie fans trying hard to get him to sell it. He's fended them off so far. He insists his commitment to keep the camper won't waver. He goes, I've been offered a lot of money for it already. And one guy said, I bet you have. I'm going to buy this from you. How much do you want for it? Name your price. I'll get the cash. And I said, it ain't for sale. He said, everything's for sale. I said, this thing's not. It's in the family. There's quite a cult following for these Blazers. And that is true. I've seen some of these Blazers sell for big money out at Barrett Jackson and some of the other auto auctions. But that is true, and that's why I wanted to read this story. That is the first Blazer that I've ever seen that was made into a camper. Pages of CNN, massive immigration raid at Hyundai mega plant in Georgia leads to 475 arrests. Most were Korean nationals. Well, hundreds of federal officers descended on a small southeastern Georgia community and raided the Hyundai mega plant, arresting 475 people in a largest sweep in the current Trump administration's immigration crackdown at U.S. work sites. The majority of those arrested on Thursday at the enormous site 25 miles west of Savannah were Korean nationals, according to Homeland Security Investigation Department. All 475 people were taken into custody were suspected of living and working illegally in the U.S. Some entered the U.S. illegally, some had visa waivers, some were prohibited from working, and some had overstayed their visas. During the raid, several people tried to flee, including a man who ran into a sewage pond on the premise. Agents used a fishing boat to get them out of the water. One of the individuals actually swam under the boat and tried to flip it over to no avail. These people were captured and identified as illegal workers. They also noted that some of the workers may have been contractors or subcontractors. We continue to work on the investigation of who exactly worked for which company. A Hyundai spokesperson told CNN he does not believe anyone arrested was a direct employee of Hyundai Motor Company. Quote, Hyundai is committed to full compliance of all laws and regulations in every market in which we operate. This includes employment verification requirements and immigration laws. And this is from a company statement on Friday night. Hyundai Motor Company of North America's chief manufacturing officer now manages the mega site. An investigation will be conducted to verify suppliers and subcontractors complying with the laws, according to the company. We are reviewing our processes to ensure that all parties that are working on projects maintain the same high standards of legal compliance that we demand for ourselves. This includes vetting the employment practices by contractors and subcontractors. Hyundai has a zero tolerance for those who do not follow the law. Now, the sprawling 2,900-acre Hyundai megaplant has two parts, the Hyundai electrical vehicle manufacturing site and an electric vehicle battery plant that's a joint venture between Hyundai and LG. The raid halted the construction at the EV battery plant, according to the Associated Press. Now, LG did not respond to CNN's questions about how many arrested workers may have been employed by their company and how many were subcontractors or contractors for LG. But the company did send the following statement to CNN. We are closely monitoring the situation and gathering all relevant details. Our top priority is always ensuring the safety and the well-being of our employees and our partners, and we are fully cooperating with relevant authorities. Well, this was not an immigration operation where agents went into the premises and rounded up folks and put them on a bus. This was a multi-month criminal investigation that had developed evidence, conducted interviews, gathered documents, and presented evidence in the court in order to obtain the judicial search warrants. At the Georgia site, masked and armed agents gave orders to construction workers wearing hard hats and safety vests as they lined up while officers raided the facility. ICE and Homeland Security investigations, also accompanied by Georgia State Patrol, FBI, DEA, ATF, and other agencies. Together, we are sending a clear and unequivocal message to those who exploit the workforce, undermine our economy, and violate our federal laws. They will be held accountable, from a Department of Homeland statement. Now, a search warrant was filed on Tuesday in the Southern District Court of Georgia reveals that officials' records were looking for violations of conspiracy to conceal and harbor or shield people in the U.S. illegally. The sought-after records included employment and recruitment records, correspondence with federal officials, identification and immigration documents. The warrant also identified four people specifically to be searched. While the raid is a part of an ongoing investigation, no charges have been filed, which means no one has been accused of wrongdoing at this time. So we'll see what happens in this situation. This is the first time that I've heard of a big automotive plant ever getting raided with regards to immigration or illegal workers. So we'll see as this story develops. And Formula One was in Holland, and it was the Dutch Grand Prix at Zandvoort, which is a beautiful track right on the sea. And Oscar Piastri from McLaren won that race. Max Verstappen finished in second. And Isaac Hager, who's driving for the Red Bulls team, the junior team for Red Bull Racing, finished in third, his first podium. And Lando Norris had an engine failure and finished in 18th. Next up, they just finished the race from Monza, and those results are coming next. Well, it's exciting. Get up and watch the Formula One race early. They start at 6 a.m. here in Phoenix time. The race just got over, and Max Verstappen wins the Italian Grand Prix at Monza. Lando Norris finished in second, and Oscar Piastri in third. Interesting enough that Lando Norris had a horrible pit stop and lost a bunch of time in the pits, but his teammate moved over for him, so he could continue to race, and he did finishing in second. But Oscar Piastri does lead the championship, but it was a dominant win by Max Verstappen, who set a new track record and sat on the pole for today's running of the Monza Grand Prix. Big motorsports news, that's IndyCar and Formula One. The headline reads, Herta gets Cadillac F1 test roll, F2 is still an option. Well, Colton Herta, current IndyCar driver, has been named as the test driver for the Cadillac Formula One team, and a switch from IndyCar to Formula Two racing for the American remains a possibility. The Cadillac Formula One entry had previously been under the guise of Andretti. Motorsports intended to run Herta as one of its two race car drivers. Herta was unable to secure a super license. The California fell just 5 points short of the 40 required for this season, and the Cadillac team is going to have Sergio Perez and Valtteri Bottas as their drivers for 2026. In order to increase chances of earning points and being eligible for the Cadillac seat in the future, Herta and TWG Motorsports have been exploring the potential of switching to the F1 feeder series for next season. Herta has confirmed he is joining Cadillac as a test driver, and multiple F2 teams have sounded off about the potential of Herta running for their team. So very excited that Colton Herta is going to get a chance to pursue his Formula One dream, and it would be great to have a Formula One driver that is an American for an American team. So that's the plan, and let's see how next year transpires. Well, let's talk a little IndyCar news, and the final IndyCar race of the season has happened last weekend in Nashville, and I'm very sad about that, but there's always next year, right? Well, Joseph Newgarden finally got a win. It took him all season, but he got his win at his hometown race in Nashville. Alex Palou finished in second, Scotty McLaughlin in third, Kiffin Simpson finished in fourth, and Connor Daly finished in fifth. So a great run for Connor as he came from the back of the field. And Pato O'Ward was leading the race and blew a right front tire, which caused him to crash into the turn three wall. So Pato O'Ward, who ended up finishing second in the championship to Alex Palou, crashed out of the race, but Joseph Newgarden wins the race in Nashville. Information regarding this for the last month or so, but it is official. Penske confirms Power departure. Will Power's tenure with Penske Motorsports has reached a long-anticipated end. Power's replacement was expected to be David Malukas, who Penske signed late in 2024 and installed him in the affiliate team with AJ Foyt Racing to develop for 2025. That announcement has not been official yet, but Willpower, the 44-year-old Australian, leaves Roger Penske's IndyCar program after 17 seasons and its most successful driver ever. Power won 42 of his 45 IndyCar races for Penske, 65 his record-setting, 71 pole positions. While strapped into a Team Penske machinery. IndyCar championships in 2014 and 2022, Penske's most recent title, also delivered Power along with victories at the Indy 500 in 2018. Quote, "It's been the honor of my life to drive for Roger and the Penske organization. We have accomplished so much together and always be grateful for my time with the team and my teammates who have supported me along the way. And after much consideration, it's time for me to make a change." So Power, of his 108 podium visits, making him making his Champ Car debut with Walker Racing, 102 of those were achieved in Penske cars. "We sat down and talked about our future together, and Will felt it was time for him to make a change beginning next season," Roger Penske said. "He has been an outstanding driver and a teammate for our organizations. His results speak for themselves. Wish him the very best in the next phase of his career." Power was recruited at the onset of the 2009 season when Penske veteran Elio Castroneves was forced to miss two races handling a tax evasion court in Florida court. And in a temporary solution, Power placed sixth in St. Petersburg and second in Long Beach before the Brazilian Castroneves returned to his car. Well, full ahead, Power embarked on his first season with Penske in 2010, capturing five wins more than any other driver, placed second in the championship, a similar pattern in 2011 where he took six wins but placed second once again to Dario Franchitti. Power finished inside the top five 13 times for Penske, and he was only matched by Penske driver Elio Castroneves. For Power, a move to Global Andretti to backfill the Colton Herta seat, who has gone to Formula One, is confirmed. So we'll see. I love it, the fact that Will Power is back in racing. Last weekend was the running of the Southern 500 at Darlington, and Chase Briscoe won the race again. He won the race last year in 2024, driving for Stuart Haas Racing. This year, he is driving for Ganassi and does it back-to-back. Tyler Reddick finishes in second. Eric Jones finishes in third. John Hunter Nemechek in fourth. And A.J. Allmendinger rounds out your top five. This weekend, they are at St. Louis, and I'll have those results for you next weekend. All right, time for some weird and unusual automotive news that was a personal experience. I work at a automotive shop called Blackwell Automotive and Blackwell Classics. I work there part-time, and on Friday we had the guy who does our gate work, so we have some big gates that needed attention. And he came in and he said, "At my last job site, I found this stray little kitty cat. I brought it in the truck. I was going to bring it home or take it to the vet. And while I was driving to your shop, the little cat got scared and crawled up into the dashboard in the truck." So we proceeded to literally take this dashboard apart to try to get this little kitty cat out. The cat would not come out. Finally, after about an hour and a half of working and putting some food and leaving the truck closed up with the air conditioning on and running to see if the little kitty would come out, it didn't. So we got a can of air for cleaning like a computer terminal and started spraying some air to see if we could motivate the kitty cat to come down. And she stuck her little head out. So I was able to grab her little head and slowly but surely pull her out of the car. So she went to the vet. She is going to be in good condition. And we have nicknamed the little kitty Dash. So I don't know if the cat's going to come live at the shop or live with a new family, but the kitty cat was rescued at Blackwell Automotive. Time, folks. Got a little car. We're going to talk about gas prices before we talk about car talk. Let's talk about gas prices with our friends at AAA. Right now, the average gas price is $3.19. Here in Arizona, we are at $3.51, New Mexico at $3.05, Colorado $3.22, Utah $3.29, Nevada $3.85, California $4.61, and you head a little bit east, Texas $2.75, Oklahoma $2.75, and over in Mississippi, the least expensive gas in the country at $2.72 a gallon. All right, let's talk about what's going on with gas prices here in Arizona. Well, gas prices are definitely up. Last week, you know, $2.49 up at the Maverick station in Grand Canyon Williams. Right now, $2.79, so up 30 cents a gallon. Still, Williams has the cheapest gas at Love's as well as Circle K. Sierra Vista, $2.85 at the 76 station there. Duncan, Arizona at the Chaparral Mini Mart, $2.86. And the Pilot Station in Quartzsite at $2.87 a gallon. All right, let's find out what's going on with our gas prices here in Metro Phoenix. All right, least expensive gas in the Metro right now is going to be at Sam's Club on Market Street in Gilbert at $3.18. The Walmart in North Scottsdale and Insight, where I got my gas, $3.18. The Costco in Scottsdale at $3.23. The Costco in Phoenix on Beardsley is at $3.29. And the 76 station on North Black Canyon Highway is at $3.34. So definitely gas prices are way, way up locally here in Metro by at least almost 15 cents. Well, we've reached that time. It's time for a little car talk. Dear Car Talk, I have a 2001 Nissan Frontier and the dipstick is stuck. I can't pull it out. And that's from Francisco. Well, that's unusual, Francisco. The dipstick is a straight metal rod with a plastic puller attached to the top. It slides through a metal tube, drops into the side of the oil pan. Not really anything that could damage it, vice versa. So the thing I would try is pull harder. Rather than pulling the plastic grabber off, I'd pull it a little lower down and see if you can get it with a pair of vice grips. Or if you break the plastic piece off, grab the top with the vice grips. If you don't feel comfortable in doing that, like you're going to break something, take it to a shop and have them go ape on it. Avert your eyes while they do that work. Well, the reality is one way or another, the dipstick has got to be free because you don't want to run out of oil in your engine. The reality is that someone has probably done something to this and it's gotten bent, which brings me back to my first suggestion, pull harder. Forcing it out could damage the dipstick tube, but replacing that tube is easier than dropping the pan. Now, there is a remote chance that when the pan was replaced, the end of the dipstick got trapped between the pan and the block. In that case, you'll have to remove the pan again, but that's very unlikely. So take it to your favorite shop and give them carte blanche to mangle it out however they can. Replace the dipstick tube if necessary, and then you'll be good to go. Good luck, Francisco. Yeah, that's an unusual one. I haven't heard about a dipstick not coming out. I have seen dipsticks that were modified by someone, and they did not reach the oil in the engine itself, so the dipstick was too short to actually do you any good. But that dipstick is critical to understand the level of oil you have in your engine. Well, folks, that's all the time we have for the car show today. My name is Jeff Wine. We'll meet you back again on the radio next Sunday, and you're listening to Sun Sounds Radio of Arizona.